Okay, today we're doing a deep dive into something, well, something everyone talks about, but maybe doesn't always get right. Feedback culture. Sounds pretty simple, right? Just talk to people. But the research, it shows this is probably one of the most powerful levers for performance,
If you get it right, yeah. It's incredibly powerful.
but also really complicated.
Exactly. It's the difference between just being told you need to improve and actually having the whole system around you to help you do it. And decades of research show if you mess it up, if feedback's done poorly, you don't just stay where you are. You can actually hurt performance, damage trust, morale, the whole thing.
So our mission for this deep dive is really to dig into the science. We're looking at organizational psychology, hard data, meta-analyses
Yeah,
to
okay.
figure out what a healthy feedback culture actually looks like, what works, and maybe even more importantly, how do you avoid those big mistakes that make it backfire?
Because it can definitely backfire.
We want those aha moments, the insights that take this beyond just, the yearly performance review chat.
Right. And the core goal for almost any organization is kind of twofold, isn't it? You want high performance, accountability,
You
learning,
want the results.
but you also need employee well-being. You need that psychological safety and feedback. That's the mechanism that connects them. A good feedback culture is where those two things finally meet.
Okay, so let's start with the definition then. If it's not just the annual review, what is a real feedback culture?
Well, fundamentally, it's an environment where people feel, well, encouraged, yes, but also genuinely safe. Safe and free to share input and also to receive it.
And it flows everywhere.
Absolutely. It has to be continuous, and multidirectional. So peer-to-peer, bottom-up, crucially from employees to leaders, and yes, of course, top-down as well.
And the sources we looked at really hammer home this point. The focus has to be super specific.
It does. The input needs to be about behaviors and results, things people can actually act on, things they can change.
Not just, you're not strategic enough.
Exactly. Never personal attributes or attacks. That just shuts people down. So you need clear norms, clear boundaries, so everyone knows that being candid is meant to be helpful, constructive, not just venting or, scoring points.
Okay, and this brings us to something really critical from the science. A finding that honestly should make anyone trying to build this culture pause. We all think feedback is good.
Right. We tend to assume so, yes.
But there was this classic meta-analysis back in 1996.
That's the big one. Kluger and DeDisi. It's like the mandatory warning sign for anyone working with feedback.
What did it find?
Well, it found that while feedback on average does improve performance, it can sometimes actually hurt performance, seriously damage it. And get this, in about one-third of all the cases they studied, feedback made things measurably worse.
Wow, one third. That's not a small risk. That's huge.
It is. It tells you this isn't just a minor issue of execution, it's fundamental.
So why? Why would giving someone information make them perform worse?
It boils down to how we as humans react to threat. If the feedback feels vague, or it's not constructive, or maybe it's just delivered badly, harshly, it triggers a threat response. It hits our self-esteem, and instantly the focus shifts from how can I learn to how do I protect myself? Defensiveness kicks in.
And then you get withdrawal or less effort.
Or just avoiding that task altogether next time. So the skill of the person giving the feedback, absolutely crucial.
So it's not just the system, it's also about the person receiving it, their readiness. This sounds like feedback orientation.
Exactly. That's the term London and Smith are introduced. Feedback orientation is basically just how willing an individual is to actively seek out feedback and then actually use it. When people start seeing feedback not as a judgment, like this is how good you are, full stop, but as useful data for growth,
With information to get better.
then the organization really starts reaping the benefits. It's a mindset shift.
And when you achieve that shift, the data on the payoff is pretty impressive. We saw that Gallup study.
Oh, yeah. Huge study. Found that employees getting regular, meaningful feedback, their turnover rates were nearly 15% lower.
15%.
And that engagement, it leads to action too. The same study found 85% of their employees took more initiative. They are more proactive.
Because the feedback signals something important.
It signals you matter, your work is seen, and we're actually invested in helping you grow. That's incredibly motivating for most people.
But, okay, that amazing payoff, that 15% lower turnover, the initiative, it all hinges on getting the environment right, avoiding that one-third failure rate.
Right.
So, how do you build that safety, that foundation?
That leads us directly to psychological safety, Amy Edmondson's work. She defines it as, essentially, a climate where people feel safe enough to speak up.
Speak up with anything.
With ideas, questions, concerns. Even admitting mistakes. Critically admitting mistakes without fearing they'll be humiliated or punished for it.
It's not just about being nice, friend.
Not at all. It's about candor. Can you be honest without facing professional ruin?
And there's solid proof this isn't just academic theory. That Google study, Project Aristotle.
Mm-hmm. Famous study. They looked at hundreds of their teams to figure out what made the best ones tick.
And psychological safety was.
It was the number one factor. More important than who was on the team, individual skills, tenure, structure, everything. Safety was the key differentiator for high performance.
Wow.
And it makes sense. Because feedback and safety, they feed each other. It's a virtuous cycle.
How so?
Well, safety allows people to give honest, respectful feedback. And then when that feedback is handled well, even if it's tough, that reinforces the trust and safety.
But if you fear the repercussions...
Then you just don't speak up. Or you water it down so much it's useless. Employees won't flag problems or share real concerns if they think it'll come back to bite them. Honesty just vanishes.
This sounds a lot like that idea of radical candor.
It connects directly. Kim Scott's idea that leaders need to do two things simultaneously. Challenge directly, but also care personally.
So the challenge, the tough feedback, is seen as an act of caring.
Exactly. Yeah. It reframes potentially difficult feedback as, I'm telling you this because I care about your growth and our shared success, not, I'm telling you this to put you down. That's the goal, anyway.
So once you've got that safety, hopefully, locked in, what are the big payoffs? The so what for someone listening? Performance has to be key.
Absolutely. Performance and learning speed up dramatically. Continuous feedback means you spot areas for improvement almost instantly.
You're not waiting a year for the review.
Right. You can make real-time adjustments. Mm. Teams become much more agile, much faster at developing skills.
And it's not just about fixing problems, is it? High-performing teams balance criticism with, well, positivity. There's that ratio.
Yes. The magic ratio. It's very memorable. Research suggests the most effective teams tend to give something like 6 positive comments for every 1 piece of critique. On average, of course.
6 to 1, that seems high.
It might sound high, but it ensures that the critical feedback lands well. It's heard, it's actionable, because the overall environment is affirming. People know they're valued, even when being challenged.
Makes sense. And this open dialogue, this constant flow, it builds trust. We saw that HBR report linking trust to stress and productivity.
Yeah, the numbers there are staggering. Employees and organizations they rated as high trust reported, on average, 74% less stress.
74%.
And 50% higher productivity. It shows a direct line from feeling safe and trusted to lower burnout and better results.
And that safety unlocks other things too, right? Like innovation.
Definitely. When people feel safe, they don't hoard ideas or hide problems. They share novel thoughts. They flag issues early before they become crises.
So the organization learns faster, adapts quicker.
Becomes more resilient, exactly. And maybe one final benefit. It really fosters a growth mindset.
Carol Dweck's work.
That's the one. The belief that your abilities aren't fixed, that you can improve with effort and, crucially, with input. Regular constructive feedback trains people to see input not as a judgment, but as fuel for getting better.
Okay, so the benefits are clear. Faster learning, more trust, less stress, innovation. But we have to address the dark side, that 1/3 failure rate. Let's pivot to the pitfalls. Why do feedback cultures fail?
Right, this is crucial. The first big trap is simply overload.
Just that. Too much feedback.
Yeah, especially too much critical feedback too often. If an organization suddenly flips a switch and says, okay, feedback all the time now. Without thinking it through.
Sounds stressful.
It is. It can create chronic anxiety, a feeling of being constantly watched, constantly judged. And paradoxically, people might shift their focus from doing great work to just trying desperately not to make any mistakes. Performance can actually dip.
So moderation is key.
Moderation, balance, and making sure feedback is often requested, not just pushed. Mm. Timing and digestibility matter.
Okay, second pitfall, the power trap. This sounds worrying.
It is. This happens when feedback stops being about growth and starts being about control.
How does that look?
Well, if leaders use the language of feedback, I'm just giving you some constructive input here, but really, they're using it to shut down dissent, enforce conformity, or constantly criticize ideas that don't fit their mold.
It becomes toxic.
Completely toxic. It kills psychological safety, suppresses creativity, and turns feedback into basically a weapon for managers. Not a tool for growth.
And linking back to that meta-analysis, the delivery matters so much, the skill gap.
This is a huge one. Giving feedback well and receiving it well, these are skills, complex social, emotional, cognitive skills.
And then we often just assume people have them.
We do. Organizations often expect employees to just, you know, take criticism on the chin, be perfectly rational, unemotional. But that's not how our brains work. Critical input often feels like a threat.
So unskilled delivery, being vague, too harsh, not specific.
It damages relationships, crushes motivation, and leads directly to those performance drops the 1996 study warned about. You have to train people.
Which ties into the next issue, the criticism spiral, forgetting the good stuff.
Yes. If the culture becomes one where the only time you get feedback is when you screw up,
people just tune out or get resentful.
Exactly. They feel unappreciated. You have to actively, consistently reinforce successes and good behaviors. Remember that 6-to-1 ratio? It's about building people up, celebrating wins, not just pointing out flaws. Otherwise, you just teach people to play it safe and never take risks.
And finally, we can't ignore that people are different. Teams are diverse.
Absolutely. Differences matter. A one-size-fits-all approach to feedback is doomed to fail.
Like being super blunt might work for some?
But could completely alienate others who need more tact, more context.
Mm-hmm.
And people come in with different levels of that feedback orientation we talked about.
Right. Some people naturally see it as threatening.
And those individuals need support, coaching, patience. You can't just hit them with harsh critique on day one and expect them to thrive. The system needs nuance, flexibility.
Okay, so we've seen the ideal, the benefits, and the major traps. Let's talk solutions. How do you actually build this right? Where do you start?
You absolutely have to start at the top. Leadership modeling. It's non-negotiable.
So leaders need to walk the talk.
They have to. They need to actively, visibly ask for feedback themselves. Regularly ask their teams things like, what's one thing I could do differently to support you better on this?
And then actually listen.
And listen without getting defensive. That's key. When leaders model seeking and receiving feedback well, it sets the standard for everyone else.
And because these are skills, you mentioned training, investing in literacy.
Yes, organizations must invest in training, not just a one-off workshop, but ongoing practice, teaching people how to structure feedback.
Like that SBI framework.
Exactly. SBI is a great, simple one. Situation, behavior, impact. In the client meeting yesterday, situation, when you presented the budget numbers, behavior, I noticed the client seemed confused about the overhead allocation, impact. It's specific, behavioral, and focuses on the result.
And training on the receiving end, too. Managing emotions.
Crucial. Helping people recognize their own emotional triggers when receiving feedback and strategies to stay open and process it constructively.
Next, making it normal. Embedding it.
Yes. Feedback needs to shift from being a big, scary event to just a normal part of the workflow, a routine habit.
How do you do that?
Things like quick feedback rounds after projects finish retrospectives, using perhaps some of those real-time continuous feedback tools or apps, and definitely making it a standard part of regular one-on-one meetings.
So it's just how we operate.
Just part of the normal rhythm of work, as common as checking your email.
I like the idea you mentioned earlier, the ask first approach.
Yeah, I think this one's really powerful. Encourage employees to proactively ask for feedback.
Instead of waiting to be told.
Exactly. They're like, hey, could you give me your perspective on how that presentation landed? Or what's one thing I could improve next time?
Flip the dynamic.
How so? It empowers the person receiving the feedback. They choose the time, the topic. It takes away a lot of the anxiety for both people and ensures the feedback is actually wanted and likely to be used.
And finally, you need clear rules of the road. Guidelines.
You absolutely do. You need to establish and communicate really clear principles for what good feedback looks like in this organization.
Like a code of conduct for feedback?
Sort of. Simple rules like we aim to be kind, candid, and specific. Or we focus on issues and behaviors, not on personalities. Having these explicit guidelines helps maintain safety and gives everyone a shared language to use if feedback does cross the line.
Okay, so pulling it all together.
Yeah, to synthesize. When you implement feedback thoughtfully, really understanding the science, building it on safety, making it a skill, practicing it consistently, you get this incredible dual payoff.
Performance and well-being.
Exactly. Higher engagement, faster learning, more agility as an organization. And at the same time, better employee well-being, less stress, less burnout. Because people feel heard, supported, invested in.
It transforms feedback from something potentially scary into just necessary conversation for getting better together.
Precisely. And the ultimate goal, I think, is to create a climate of what you might call good tension.
Good tension.
Yeah, an environment where people feel safe enough to genuinely challenge each other, to push for excellence, but they always do it with mutual respect and a sense of care.
That's a powerful goal.
It is. So maybe the final thought we leave you, the listener, with is this. Think about your own workplace, your own team. Right now, do people generally see feedback as an act of caring, aimed at growth, or does it feel more like an act of judgment?
That difference.
That difference is probably the truest measure of whether your feedback culture is succeeding or failing.